Good morning and welcome to Manzanita Voices, the show for writers and all of you who love the written word. We have a great show for you today with my guest, playwright Rick Foster. He's written plays on many different subjects, and California history is a big part of his subject matter. We're going to be hearing from Rick in just a few minutes, but first, I want to thank you guys for your terrific response. Last week, as usual, during Lucy Hackett's show on sending out press releases, I asked you to send in something for morning workout. And as usual, I didn't get much response. And so over the weekend when I sent out my notice to all of you about what the show was going to be on Sunday, I happened to mention in my email that I didn't have anything to read today for morning workout. And guess what? You guys really responded. So I know you're reading my emails, but I wonder, are you listening to the show? We're on every Sunday at 9 o'clock California time, and you can listen to us. I'm sure if you are listening to us right now, of course, you know it's www.kvgcradio.com. And, of course, my shows are archived on my website at www.manzamedia.com. There's one thing about that I want to explain. Some people, I guess, are thinking, which would be logical, that as soon as we've done a show, you'll be able to hear it next week or in a few days on my website archived. Unfortunately, it doesn't work that way. I'm very technologically uninformed. And I don't know how to convert the CD disc to whatever it needs to be put on my website. So I have to have that done for me. And it takes sometimes a month or two for the people that I who help me out with this to find the time to do it. So there's a big delay in the shows. That's why you should listen as the show is being broadcast. That way you can keep up that way. Anyway, also, my email address, for those of you who want to send me something for morning workout, and that would be something that's 2 minutes long. It could be prose, poetry, whatever. Your thoughts on a subject, if they're nicely written. We'd love to have it to read in this time for morning workout. And my email address is linda@manzamedia.com. Notice, this is Manzanita Voices, linda@manzamedia.com. Website is manzamedia.com. This all comes from the wonderful Manzanita bush or tree that is so ubiquitous here in California in the foothills. And it is our logo and our trademark. So I do have... Because of your wonderful response to my email, I do have a couple of nice poems that I'm going to read this morning. And the first one is from Michael Duffett. He teaches at Delta College. He has taught, oh my goodness, in many places all over the world. He's a prolific writer, has quite a long bio. I don't have time to get into that here, but he has a little poem that is a comment on our American society, where we Americans think that bigger is always better and technology reigns supreme. He based this poem on an African saying, which is, "No one tests the depth of the river with both feet." That's an interesting thought. No one tests the depth of the river with both feet. I suppose that is because they'd be in over their head if they did something foolish like that. And he's commenting on that thought and contrasting it with our society. It's called African Wisdom. Michael Duffett. "No one tests the depth of the river with both feet" is an African pearl. Do we in the West have even a sliver of wisdom, of this wisdom from the middle of the world? We jump in with both feet. We give it all we've got. We take the biggest swing. In the fairway, The bigger the divot the golf club digs, the higher the ball on the wing. Are ancient Africans qualified to counsel restraint to modern Western man? Do we, at the pinnacle of pride in technology, need our limits to scan? Rivers in Africa are old and deep. Do we moderns need to wake from sleep? That's something to think about. Thank you, Michael. Now, speaking of technology, Jim Turner sent in a poem, and it kind of goes nicely with Michael's poem. Jim Turner suggests that we consider Adam and Eve. How did they finally clothe themselves when they decided that they needed to do that? And could we do it if we were in their shoes? I've often thought if we had some horrible, horrible, catastrophic change to our life, we would be really in trouble because none of us knows how to do anything that people took for granted doing back in the 1800s. We'd all be in serious trouble. So Jim put this note. One of my pet themes is technological illiteracy. Who among us could make a needle, starting with iron ore, if we knew what that is, and without a match to start a fire? We take so much for granted, says Jim. So here's his poem. It's called Adam the Tailor, or I Haven't a Thing to Wear. Unhoused, untrousered, and untutored, unpossessed of tweedle or needle, wishing himself and spouse accoutred warmer, Adam coolly schemed to wheedle wool from goats. I'll sharpen shears to clip them with, and twist in wire an eye to thread through. Freshman fears grew, for Adam knew not fire, nor furnace, iron ore, nor coke. He found no wire, made no sharp steel, and dreamed no loom nor spinning wheel. Though close to fire he came with smoke and blisters. It's that snake, I grieve, still at it, knitting crooked hitches in my way. Meddler, I'll never weave worsted to stick good stitches in. Though long he labored up in Adam, better dressed than freezing Adam were those shaggy kids, a goatly sin, each paid for dearly. So naive. For kilts, quick Adam fleeced them, skin and wool, then wooed his shivering Eve with nanny fur. The latest style for you alone, slick Adam said. Technology would take a while, so they debuted in ready-made. And, save the goat who bared his back, no one snickered there off the rack. And save the goat whose back was bared, no one noticed and no one cared. Thank you, Jim Turner. We always like to hear from you, and I love to hear from everybody. So please do send me your morning workout submission at linda@manzamedia.com. All right. Well, now it's time for my guest, Rick Foster. Welcome, Rick Foster.
Thank you, Linda.
You are a prolific playwright.
That was a question.
No, actually, that was a statement. I have looked at the long, impressive list of the plays that you have written, and I've had the pleasure of seeing one of your plays read in Sonora back in November. I wrote a little blog about it on my website, and I was just so blown away by that play. I just had to have you come on the program, and I'm so glad to have you here.
Thank you.
I see that for your education, you first got in a Bachelor of Science degree in mathematics at the California Institute of Technology.
Newly rated the best university in the world by an international commission, yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
No kidding, I did not know that.
Won out over MIT and Harvard and Yale and Stanford and all of the others.
Oh, my goodness. Well, that is really wonderful then. And so, obviously, you are a mathematician. You like science and math, and you your brain works that way.
I love science and math, but I don't claim I'm an ex-mathematician. It's not it's something you have to keep up with if you're really going to claim that you're one. You know, I may once have thrown a no-hit game, but I'm not a pitcher anymore. <you know? laughs>
Well, I'm sure that even though math is a science that has firm and fixed qualities to it, the practice of mathematics changes so drastically with our technology and our society that you really would have to keep up.
Oh, that's right. The fields that I was conversant in 50 years ago, I would try to read a modern article in that, and I would just have to go back to square one.
Well, I think it's pretty impressive anyway. I've always been impressed by mathematicians. But then, about 5 years later, after you, were you planning to teach math? Was that what you wanted to do with it?
I thought I would, and I went to graduate school in Berkeley in mathematics, and I had kind of like when people lose their religious faith. I mean, it just lost its beauty for me.
Oh.
And I can still recognize, I mean, my initial attraction to it was aesthetic more than practical. I just found the proving of things and the way mathematical astonishing results can come out of this fundamental thinking was just gorgeous to me. And I was working with these great mathematicians, I mean, working with, I was studying under these great mathematicians at Berkeley. And I was married at the time, and my marriage was falling apart. And I started writing poetry out of the pain that was emerging in my life. And I found a passionate attachment to that practice. I would go into the fabulous stacks and just pick out poetry books at random and sample the hundreds of poets when I should have been working on my mathematics.
Oh.
And I went to my advisor, who was a major mathematician, and he seemed like a child when it came to emotional matters. And suddenly there was a seismic shift in my soul, and I realized that I really wanted to explore the world of feeling more than the world of the purity of mathematics. But I still love and admire science and try to keep up on at a layperson's level on many things that are happening. So I worked for about 7 years. I dropped out of graduate school in 63, and for the next 7 years or so, I worked in operations research and mathematical statistics for the Bell System, first for Pacific Tel and then for the Bell Labs, and then I consulted with AT&T for a while on an algorithm. I can use that word now. It was hard to use it 50 years ago. On an algorithm I'd created for the distribution of wires in the ground.
Mm-hmm.
But then I went back and got my master's degree in San Francisco State in creative writing and English, and it's been that road ever since.
That road ever since, yeah. And you know what? I think having seen your play, Women of the Bear, your background in mathematics it's part of the way you write, because the Women of the Bear has so many threads woven through it so beautifully. It's almost mathematic in its beauty.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. I, as are, for example, the Pomo culture that I refer to weaves very mathematical passions into their basketry. So,
that's true. They do.
So it has roots in that kind of structure, has roots in mathematics, but also in popular culture as practiced hundreds and thousands of years ago.
Yes, it's all a progression. We'll be back in just a moment with more from Rick Foster. Welcome back to Manzanita Voices. This is Linda Field, and today we're talking with Rick Foster, playwright. Rick, before we left, we were talking about how you switched from mathematics to you changed over to English. You got your master's in English.
English and creative writing.
And creative writing.
Yeah.
Okay. So why don't you continue from there?
Well, I spent the time when I was working for the Bell System writing a novel and writing poetry and teaching myself my way of writing poetry. And then I decided to go back and get the master's degree from San Francisco State, which has a wonderful creative writing department.
Mm.
And while I was there, my second wife and I had moved to Santa Cruz, and we were, you know, part of the scene there. And there was a young woman, an actress, who was needed a senior project, and she was an ambitious young woman, and she said, I've always thought I'd like somebody to write me a play. And I said, oh, I'll write you a play. And so I wrote a play, a play based on an Irish myth about the cattle raid on Cooley, which is one of the kind of Trojan War sort of versions of Irish mythology.
And you just happened to know about this?
I'd come across it reading Joseph Campbell, who had talked about this particular myth at some length, and I got very interested in it. So I made a comedy out of this. It begins with a husband and wife in bed arguing over who has the best bull. And it turned out he has the better bull, so she decides she has to get a bull better than her husband's bull, and out of that a whole war ensues.
Oh my goodness.
But I had in my own personal myth, theater was a part, because my parents had met in a theater. My father was working as a stage manager at the Long Beach Playhouse, and my mother was in a high school drama. She was a senior in high school. She was about to turn 18, and he was about 24, 25. And she was in this chorus of this musical number, and at the end of the chorus, there was supposed to be an offstage gunshot. And my father was the one who was to fire this starting pistol, like the pistol they start races with. And the girls were coming off stage, and cue came for the pistol. He squeezed the trigger, and nothing happened.
Oh, no.
And he brought the pistol down to see what was the matter, and just at that instant, the pistol was pointed at my mother.
Oh, no.
Now, it doesn't have a bullet in it, it just has a wad of cotton. It was pointed at my mother, whom he didn't really know, and he saw the hammer start to release. So he just quickly threw his hand up in front of the pistol. He got this wad of blazing cotton in his palm.
Wow.
And struck up a conversation with the girl he had
saved
from. and 7 years later, I came along.
Oh, how wonderful! That's a nice story.
So I always thought that history was that theater would become part of my history.
Uh-huh.
And this was the opportunity to follow up on that with this young woman who I wrote the play for.
I see.
And
now you say, though, that you wrote a novel before that, and I just want to ask a quick question. I guess you found playwriting your vehicle, but I would think playwriting would be more difficult in many ways than writing a novel.
It is and it isn't. It's a restrictive form. I mean, you just can't digress very much in a play. Things more or less have to all contribute.
Mm-hmm.
At least in Western theater. I think in Chinese opera there was a lot of digression, but but in Western dramatic expectations of the audience, you pretty well have to set up very early on what the play is about and the question that will be answered in order for the play to end, like, will they get married or will he die?
Mm-hmm.
To take the whereas a novel allows considerably more byways. So in that sense, a play is harder to write. On the other hand, if you're not holding out for a big commercial success, a play is easier to produce. I mean, you can get plays produced yourself, or you can find a group of people who are interested in it, and you can find a way to produce it. You may only produce it for a few performances with minimal technical support,
mm-hmm.
but it does let you get experience in dealing with a public more easily, I think, than all but the most gifted and lucky fiction writers.
So that first play that you wrote, how did it feel for you to see it performed and see the audience reaction?
It was exhilarating.
I bet it was.
But more than that, just the process of of being around a group of people focused on something as impractical as telling a story to a group of other people, and being passionately involved in the lights and the costume and the sets and the way you represent the piece to the public, and just the group activity of it. I'm basically a loner, but this is my way of really loving being with a group of people and working for a common cause that that's not making money, but just telling a story.
And they were all doing all of this activity because of something that you had created.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. You know, there's definitely that narcissistic aspect of it, that it's all me and you're all working on what I've done.
Oh, my goodness. So now, did you direct that first play?
I did not, no. I knew nothing about directing. A friend of mine, I had actually performed in a play, in an adaptation of Aeschylus's Oresteia at Cabrillo College, which was directed by a brilliant young man who later became a priest. But he was quite wonderful, and that was exhilarating. And one of the young women in the play was a theater major. She later became an attorney, but she directed the play, my play, because we'd become friends. And
I see.
I didn't direct anything for quite a while, maybe several years before I first undertook directing something, and then
I see.
I've done it occasionally since then.
Now, before we go any further, I want to make sure I mention that you've received a Lifetime Achievement Award. In 2001, you received the Director's Award given by the California Arts Council for immeasurable contribution to the field of playwriting in California, and it was presented to you in September of that year at the annual meeting of Theater Bay of Theater Bay Area in San Francisco.
Yeah.
Quite an honor.
That was great. That was very nice, yes.
Yes. And a lot of your plays do have to do with the history of California, but you have such a variety of other topics that you've written about. You even wrote a play about Seabiscuit.
I did, yes.
Yes.
Well, that is even a California story, you know.
Yes, it is, yeah.
I mean, Seabiscuit was born in the East, but it was a California owner who brought him here and led him to the great sports career. It's a great sports story, really.
Oh, yeah.
Of a fabulous athlete who just had this amazing heart and ability to focus and win. I mean, I'm talking about the horse.
Yeah.
And there was a lot of sort of poo-pooing of Seabiscuit by war admirals, owners, and all of the big breeders in the East. And when Seabiscuit came out of nowhere and became the greatest horse of America for a few years, it was a real hometown story for me. I mean, I was a baby at the time, but for me to read about it.
Sure.
In the year 2000.
Yeah, I remember seeing the movie. I really loved the movie, and I loved the part about the fact that Seabiscuit was a very kind of a neurotic horse and was calmed down by the presence of a goat. They got Seabiscuit a goat to keep it
company. He loved to have something else in the...
He was lonely.
Maybe he was neurotic. He was high strung and goats,
he didn't sleep. Something about he didn't sleep or he didn't eat much.
Because I think he knew he had to rev himself up.
Yeah.
To be up with these people who were probably physically better horses than he was, but he had the spirit that could win. And goats are really wonderful creatures to have around.
Well, I know Seabiscuit thought so. What's your favorite play that you've written? Do you have a favorite?
Oh, you know, that's like asking somebody what their favorite child is.
Yeah.
I mean, in one sense, it's the one I'll write after the one I write next, because it still has all, it's a huge universe of evanescent possibilities glowing around it, and it hasn't faced the actualities of getting the words down on the page. But, wow, what's my favorite? You know, one loves them for different reasons. I mean, in some ways I love plays that didn't make it because I think I was trying something that I almost got or maybe did get, but the production didn't quite get.
Mm-hmm.
I have a play that I wrote for Sierra Repertory Theater called Uncle Sam's Fandango.
I saw that in here, yes.
Yeah. And it's set in the Gold Rush around the time of the foreign miners' strike. I mean, there was almost a war in the mother lode in 1850 because immigration. I mean, they didn't want people who the U.S. miners didn't like it that there were Hispanic and French people digging out their gold, even though some of the Hispanic people had been around California for 100 years at that time, 75 years anyway. And that play is an epic play. I mean, it tries to deal with the whole sweep of things. The central character is a poet who is also a newspaper man, like Walt Whitman was. In fact, he has a Whitman-esque sensibility and writes Whitman-esque poetry, which was only believable because Whitman also did it. So I imagine somebody else doing that kind of stuff. And we see it largely through his point of view. And that play, I haven't gotten another production of it, and I do really love it and grieve the fact that I haven't gotten another production.
So if you could have one of your plays put on anew, you would choose that one? That's the one you would.
Oh,
push
I don't
right
know. If you
raise asking
that,
you to choose again.
Yeah, because there might be other plays that I would think maybe would be more successful than that one. So I'm going to bow out of answering your question.
Oh, okay.
Which one's my favorite? Because I can't stand to hurt any of them.
They do have their own feelings. Yeah. We'll be back in just a few moments with more from Rick Foster. Welcome back to Manzanita Voices. Rick Foster is here talking about the plays that he has written. And Rick, so many of your plays deal with California history. How did you come to be so interested in the history of this state?
I was born in Sacramento, and I grew up in Santa Cruz, where we moved after the Second World War.
Oh.
And I was always a passionate Californian. I always thought, even as a boy, somehow California had something very important to give the world.
Mm, it does.
And I had enthusiasms for the missions and things, but I didn't get deeply into California history as a child. And when I got into my 20s, which is during the 60s, when there was a lot of rethinking of a lot of things, I realized that I had basically been deprived of the truth about California history, that the native peoples here had much more complicated and interesting and successful societies with very little war, with people could live to be quite an old age. They were hunter-gatherers. They had very interesting ways of solving conflicts, conflict resolution between communities. They had fixed locations. They weren't nomadic. They didn't travel around.
And they actually built villages.
They built villages. Sometimes one tribe would have two villages. They would have their summer village and their winter village, which is what we all aspire to have.
That's right.
And I realized that the dark side of California history had been very much suppressed. And then I started realizing how the role women played. Of course, the role of women was problematic throughout history, really, but had special things in California history. So I got interested in California women and Native Californians and other aspects of early life here. Also the Mexican-American community, and how all of those things factored in, and the Chinese contribution to the state. So all of that began to interest me, and I thought I wanted to find a way to explore that in writing. I was working in the middle 90s as a dramaturg, as sort of the script manager and so on, at Sierra Repertory Theater in Sonora, and they got some grant money to hire me to work full-time and to create some work, and they asked me what I wanted to do, and I said, well, I want to write some plays to tour schools on California history. And they said, great, let's do that. And so I did. I wrote the first three of those plays. all 45 minutes long.
What were the first three?
The first three were Gunpowder Man, about the Chinese and the Taiping Rebellion, which was this huge civil war in China in the 1850s and into the early 1860s, that was actually responsible for part of the pressure for Chinese people to get out of China, because whole villages were being burned by the emperor's armies after they got control of the revolution. And then the people came here, and they were absolutely instrumental in getting the Central Pacific Railroad through the Sierras, which is a monumental feat given the engineering capabilities of the time. And then they were kind of cut loose and worked on other railroads, but then there was bad economic downturn at the end of the 70s and into the 80s, and very similar to Arizona today, get them out of the country, they don't belong here, they're not us, America for the Americans, whatever that means. So all of these were very interesting. So that was Gunpowder Man.
Then and you put all that in 45 minutes.
then I wrote a longer version.
Okay.
which has been done twice, expanded to a full hour and a half of theater. Then I wrote a play called Friendly Fire, about gold miner who comes here in 49 with a crowd of guys from River Town in Missouri. And they're not doing very well, and the leaders of their little group, the rich people from the town of Atticus that I have them from, a made-up town, say, well, they know where they can find some gold, and they lead them into the back country, and they find a group of Indians that are mining a gold claim.
Mm-hmm.
And they kill the Indians and take over the gold claim. And my narrator is so disgusted by what's happened, he just tries to run away, and he gets lost in the mountains and thrown by his horse and rescued by an Indian village. And so he lives with them for many months and really realizes that he knew absolutely nothing about what their way of life was actually like. So it's a story of his education and also provides the audience an education into what the real anthropological situation was at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And then the story comes out of that. And the third one is one that I haven't redone because it requires a very good singer. It's called Corrido de un Sobreviviente, the Ballad of the Survivor.
Mm-hmm.
And it's about a boy who is born in the state of Sonora in Mexico, and he's born on a ranch, and some Apaches have a raid on this ranch, and almost everybody is killed, but he is left in a well, and when the carabinieri, or the militia, comes out, they find him, and he's raised by this rich family. This is a historical family, the Ainsa family, who and he turns out to have a great singing voice, so they make him their house entertainer, even as a boy, because he can sing these songs beautifully.
Mm.
And then he gets trained some and becomes the pet of the daughter of this Ainsa family.
Mm.
And they're kind of friendly towards the U.S. during the Mexican-American War, so they become, their life becomes difficult in Sonora, and they migrate to San Francisco in the 1850s. And their daughter, the historical person, marries a guy named Henry Crabb, who becomes one of the filibusteros. Do you know about the filibusters?
No.
These were Americans who were mostly from slave states and had the dream of parts of Mexico and Central America being annexed to the United States and entering as slave states, because the slave states were worried about becoming overwhelmed by the... So this is pre-Civil War stuff.
Uh-huh.
So this Henry Crabb, this actually happens, thinks that if he leads a little army into the state of Sonora, a whole bunch of the people who are dissatisfied with Mexico will come to his side. Well, exactly the opposite happens, and his little army of 60 people, 59 of them are executed.
Ooh.
But this is my character tells the story. This story, he's all along on the expedition, but gets away because he is himself a native Sonoran.
Wow.
So those are the three first ones.
My goodness, you managed to pack a lot of history into a 45-minute play.
It's
amazing.
It's a really nice, but this one, of course, requires somebody who can really sing both Mexican songs and finally a little opera at the end. So I haven't recast it yet to find somebody else to do it.
Well, maybe someone listening to this show will know someone who would like to be in it.
There's a company called Teatro Nahual, run by Richard Falcone and a couple of other people who produced a play about Cesar Chavez, and he talks about finding a way to do this show, but it hasn't happened yet.
Oh, gosh. Well, I hope it does. I would love to see it.
I do, too. I would love to have this one done again.
Oh,
It's the music and the story, I'm really happy with the way they work together.
Oh, how wonderful. You wrote the music.
No.
Oh, no,
The music is all...
It's all
pre-existing stuff. Yeah, yeah,
traditional music.
Yeah.
Oh, I bet it would be wonderful. Well, then, the play that I saw, The Women of the Bear, would you talk a little bit about that one? Because it so impressed me.
Yes, that's actually one of my favorite plays. I'd put it away for quite a few years. And when I...
It's been produced only once, in 1998 in Sonora, at Stage 3.
That's the only time at Stage 3. Yes, after I left Sierra Rep, I created the full-length version of Gunpowder Men for Stage 3, and they liked it so much they asked me to do another play from scratch. And this was the play I chose to do because there were these really interesting women's stories going around. Jesse Benton Fremont, of course, is a major historical character for anyone who gets into that period, and her father was a great senator from the state of Missouri. Nancy Kelsey is known by a lot of people. In fact, my brain is going bad now, but there's this Nevada historical writer. She wrote a lot of stuff about the Middle Ages. Cecilia Holland, and wrote a Nancy Kelsey book. And so she interested me very much. And the Stanislaus National Forest, the historian there, and some of the other people had a work done on Nancy Kelsey because she walked through the National Forest. So I had access to archives there. And then through the great work of Malcolm Margolin and the Heyday Press, there are quite a few books of oral history that deal with the Native American experience, and I got a lot of material of that for the third play, which is this composite character of several women, Pomo or North Bay and up to Mendocino County women. So that was the background, and I just got into telling these three women's stories from their own point of view, and it just came out that each of them has a very strong relationship with their man and their family, and each of them loses a child. So that became one of the unifying themes of it. I feel I'm not doing a good job of getting you into the emotionality of it. Why don't you tell me what impressed you about this story?
Oh, my goodness. I was so impressed. But unfortunately, I'll have to tell you more about it when we come back because it's time for a break. Please stay tuned. Okay, we're back with Rick Foster, and I was going to talk about the impact that The Women of the Bear had on me. When I went to see this play, it just happened I saw in the paper that it was being given that night, and so a spur of the moment, I went over to Sonora. It was being read. It was not an acted out stage play. It was being read in an art gallery on Main Street.
The Central Sierra Arts Council.
Yes, yeah. Yes. Which we are, we're, this show and our writers group and our publishing company are under the auspices of the Calaveras County Arts Council.
Right.
So we have a lot to thank the Arts Councils for.
Oh, we do. Give money to the
Please
Arts Councils.
Please, join, yes. You should all have a membership to the Arts Council. It's only about $35 a year, I think, and you get so much benefit from it. They put on concerts. They do all kinds of wonderful things. Anyway, I went to the gallery that night to see the reading of Women of the Bear. There were three actresses. Each one was highlighted in each of three acts, and they read, and Laura Ford McNichol, who read Jesse Benton Fremont, was so impressive as a woman from the upper class. You know, as Rick said, her father was a United States Senator. She was married to John Charles Fremont. Then Nancy Roberts Kelsey was read by Susanna Holland, and Nancy was a woman who wasn't even able to read and write, and she was the first white woman who came over the Sierra Nevada into what became California. And then Lucy Elder, the composite of the Native American women, was read by Ashley Flowers. These three women are fabulous actresses. Anyway, what so impressed me was the fact that each of these women had had a tragedy in her life where she lost an infant. And that was interwoven. These women were here in this brand new, not even a state yet, and they were interacting with the people who created California, and they had their own instrumental part in it. And it was so woven together. That's what I meant when I said that your mathematics background came through,
right?
Because the I'm at a loss for words.
Architecture is a word I like.
Architecture, yes. It was just a wonderfully constructed play with the lives of these women. I may add something later, but okay. So anyway, when you wrote that play, Rick, was it for Duende, your company Duende?
Duende was about to be born at that time.
Okay.
After writing these plays for Sierra Rep, they were not interested in, you know, in reproducing them and carrying them around. I thought I felt they really deserved more of a life. And so I talked with an old friend of mine for whom I'd written plays back in the 70s and in the early 80s, Tom McGuire, who was living in Los Angeles, in Hollywood at that time. And I said, what would you think of coming up here and founding a company, and you would tour, and I gave him the Friendly Fire play, which I'd written for another actor named Van Gordon, who was not interested in going on with it. You would do this, and we would work on other plays about California history, and by the way, I've just been writing this Women of the Bear, and I think the middle one of those plays, the Nancy Kelsey play, would be a good one to tour. It stands alone on its own, and we would just, you know, start there and tour plays all over America, which seemed possible in the economic climate of 1998. And so he came up, and we founded the company, and 2 years later we turned nonprofit, and its goal is to bring the truth about history, both the history of California and the history of science, to the people, especially to the schools of California, but also to adult groups. We've performed for archaeological societies, historical societies, lots of other things as well as students. But and we've built from that, and we're still going now, 14 years later.
So your plays are being produced in schools as we speak?
Yes, right now Tom is touring The Air We Share, which is my most recent play from 2 years ago, about the great ferment at the beginning of modern chemistry around the time of the American Revolution. The central character is a man named Joseph Priestley, who was a wonderful Englishman. He was a Unitarian minister, but very forward-thinking, who took the side of the colonies, even though he was a minister in England and got his house burned down for it and emigrated to America. But he was one of the three people who first isolated what we now call oxygen. And so he comes back to the schools as a person now who's just come from the dead to tell the kids the story of his life and the story of this birth of one part of science. And so that play is being toured to the primary schools of sixth grades especially. Mm. It addresses the sixth grade science curriculum of Tuolumne County. And then in the spring, Tom will be touring Friendly Fire again, the one about the 49ers and the Miwok. And a couple of years ago, we got enough money to bring Gunpowder Man about the Chinese and the building of the railroad to all the schools of Tuolumne County and some in Sacramento and so on. So we keep chipping away, even though the ability of schools to pay for these things has completely disappeared. We find other ways to finance them, but we're sort of waiting out this long, slow drought of
aren't we all
of money for these things that are really essential to living a rich life.
Yes, yes. Well, I hope that people hearing this, especially if you live in California, will look into these plays. Go to Rick's website. Let's do your website right now.
The website is www, of course, but I don't even think you need that anymore with most computers. Duende Drama, DuendeDrama.org. And that will take you, and you can browse around. We have descriptions of about 14 plays or something like that that we have done, and you can read teachers' materials, some of the backup materials we've collected or written for it, and find out what we're doing.
Yeah, and use what you learned last week from Lucy Hackett about sending out press releases, and get yourselves together and find a way to raise money in your community so that this some of Rick's plays can be put on in your schools.
If you have
your
any
kids
ideas,
need this knowledge.
Do email us at just info@duendedrama.org, and we'll follow up on your ideas as best we can.
Yeah, the two of you working together, the community and Rick Foster working together through his website, you can find a way to enhance the education of your children, because that is one of the most important things we have going on here. We need to work on that. I had to ask you when we were just talking about what the word duende means. Where does it come from?
Oh, it's a word that exists in many Spanish speaking cultures and means different things in different places. But for me, it means the great Spanish poet García Lorca said it means, which is a spirit that lives in the earth and wants to be expressed. And so, if flamenco it was the example he used, you know, the great dancing, guitaring, singing tradition of the southern part of Spain, and he said the duende, if the person is receptive to it, will enter through the artist's soles of their feet and fill them with the charisma to actually truly perform the work of art. And then he applies the concept. He says, for example, Johann Sebastian Bach, even though he's very mathematical and precise, has the same duende spirit. And so I thought, I love that idea, and I want to have that kind of energy come to me through the earth.
And I think it does. I really do. And any of the work that you produce seems to, I bet it has it. I've seen only the one play, but I can tell by just talking to you and reading the synopsis of all the plays you've written. What I want to talk about is so different from your other California history plays, is Vivian.
Ah, Vivian, yes.
That's been put on. I was looking through your whole list of plays, and Vivian, Spring Awakening, and Love Isadora are three that have been put on in many parts of the country. Vivian was put on in Buffalo, New York, and I like
just
that because I'm from
year.
Buffalo.
I noticed that. Yeah, it was just done in October.
Okay.
In fact, October into November. So, and they I didn't get a chance to go see it, but they said it went very well, and they were very happy with the production.
Oh, good. So tell us a little bit about Vivian.
Well, there is an actress who's a wonderful actress. Mm. She works mostly in Sacramento now, but at that time she was on the company at Sierra Rep, that time being the middle 90s. And but she occasionally acted in Sacramento then, and she was in a production in B Street Theater.
What's her name?
Janice Stevens.
Okay. Yeah.
She's also a fabulous director. She's one of the best directors I've ever had do my work.
I used to see her at B Street a lot because I was a member of B Street.
Well, back then she was in a play at B Street, and her dressing room mate said, "You know, Janice, you actually look quite a lot like Vivian Leigh. Why don't you get somebody to write you a play about it?"
Oh.
And Janice, who is very diffident in some way, said, "Well, Rick, my, you know, so-and-so said that I should have somebody. You wouldn't be interested in doing that, would you?" And I said, "Well, you know, I don't really know a lot about her yet, but there's two things I know that really interest me. One is she was one of the most beautiful women of her age. And we'll wait until the next segment for about the rest of the story."
Oh, no. Take about another half a minute and just finish that up, because we do have to stop. But I want to hear a little bit more about Vivian.
And the second thing that I found fascinating about her was that I knew that she was a... Oh, no. Let's start over again.
Okay.
The first thing I knew was that she was one of the most beautiful women of her or any other age. And I had been interested in what I call the curse of beauty, the fact that very beautiful people are often cursed because they are defined by their beauty, mm-hmm. and people don't want to pay attention to their minds or anything that, you know, that spoils their image of the person's perfect beauty. That interested me.
Mm-hmm.
And then, being a stage person myself, I knew that she was a great film actor who actually much preferred being on stage to being on screen, and the making of films was not fun for her, and the making of plays, the routine of going to the dressing room and making yourself up and all of the rituals of the theater were absolute home for her. She was at home in the theater. And so those two things interested me. And then when I got into her biography and found out that she was bipolar, or what they called manic depressive then, and had to undergo hellish shock treatments and would completely lose control of herself.
Oh, I didn't know that
manic
about
attacks.
Her.
And then she had this relationship with this man who she was absolutely adored, Laurence Olivier, but the marriage broke up with extreme painfulness. Those things all coalesced into me saying to Janice, "Yes, I'll write a play about Vivian Leigh for you."
Oh, well, I hope we get to see it sometime. Is there any plan, just quickly, is there any plan to have that one produced again in this area?
Not
California?
Right now. She did a run at Sacramento Theater Company about 4 years ago, which was a huge sold out massively. I mean, I don't know why they didn't bring it back the next season when they were in such financial troubles, but who knows how theater managers
how decisions
make
are
their
made.
Decisions.
That's
it's a mystery
right.
to us playwrights.
I'm sure it is. It has been such a pleasure having you with us today. I thank you for coming, and perhaps you'll come back again.
Oh, you're
time.
Very welcome, and I would love to come back sometime.
Okay. Everyone out there, have a nice week. I look forward to seeing you back here again for Manzanita Voices next Sunday.
You've been listening to Manzanita Voices, a production of the Manzanita Writers Press, an affiliate of the Calaveras County Arts Council.